Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Bruce Pierce with our initial podcast entitled Women's Healthcare. And today I have with me my co-host, Dr. Seth Derman. He is with Princeton IVF here in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Hello, Dr. Derman.
Hello, Dr. Pierce.
So, Dr. Derman, tell us about Princeton IVF. How long have you been here? What's it all about? When did it start? Where are you located?
Well, I've been here for about 22 years. I initially trained in medical school at University of Pittsburgh and then did a residency in New York and a fellowship down at University of Maryland. And then I worked somewhere else for a year and then I started the practice and joined the practice that was here about 22 years ago.
Great. Well, welcome. So Dr. Derman and I have the pleasure of working with each other for that long a period of time. So we go way back. So tell me, Dr. Derman, you're a specialist in infertility, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a patient who feels I have an infertility problem or trouble getting pregnant, what do I do? What's the first step? How long do I have to be trying to have a baby to think I have a problem? Is it like three weeks, and if I'm not pregnant, I guess I'll come see you?
Well, some of my patients do think that, but really we consider a year of trying of unprotected intercourse to be normal infertility. People who are over 35, we actually encourage them to come in a little early, around 6 months. And people who have irregular cycles, we encourage them to come in early also, because a lot of times people with irregular cycles will need help anyway, so there's really no reason to delay treatment.
Okay, so I'm a patient, I'm trying 6 months, but I have irregular periods, and I come and see you. What am I to expect?
Well, the first visit is mostly just talking. We get your history and get an idea of what's going on, what your cycles are like, if there's any other things we need to be concerned about. For example, if you've had an infection in the past that could blocked your fallopian tubes, or your partner had something that could affect it. But basically, we start a workup. We start doing some blood work. And if your cycles are regular, oftentimes we'll put you on a fertility drug right away and start trying to fix the ovulation right away.
Okay. Now, I heard there's a battery of tests I have to go through, and some of those tests could be painful. Is that true?
Well, it depends what you're doing. There are a battery of tests. Only one of the tests that we do routinely, the HSG, which is a test to see if the fallopian tubes are open, can be painful. But not everybody has that. Like, for example, if you're coming in for regular cycles, we may start the treatment before we even do that testing.
Now, I often get asked by my patients, who I refer to you, by the way, of course.
Thank you.
You're welcome. They ask, well, should my partner come with me, or is it just me, the patient, who needs to see?
We actually encourage the partners to come. First of all, we want them to be an active participant in what's going on. Infertility is not a him or her thing. It's really a couple thing. And regardless of where the problem lies, assuming we find a problem, it still is a good idea to speak with both partners, and we usually will evaluate both partners as well.
Okay, so me and my partner will go to see you, and we go through this. So is there options then? Do I have to do in vitro? Does it depend on what's going on?
Oh, it depends quite a bit. Most people who come in don't actually need in vitro. Most people who come in, they get pregnant with simpler methods, whether it's insemination, whether it's doing fertility drugs. There are other options as well. But first, we have to start out, besides by getting a history, by doing some tests. The HSG we talked about, we test for something called ovarian reserve to make sure the eggs are not starting to run out. We check to make sure ovulation is good, and we do a semen analysis on the male partner to make sure his sperm is okay.
Oh, so it could be the male partner's.
It's just as likely, in fact.
Aha. Uh-huh. So what about age? How young is too young, and how old is too old to seek fertility treatments?
Well, a lot of it depends on what your concerns are. For example, if we have someone who's young, even if they've been even if they're young, let's say they're 18, 19 years old, if they've been trying for a few years, they certainly should be evaluated, because it's not normal for an 18-year-old to have trouble getting pregnant, and maybe there's something really serious going on. When patients are older, a lot of it depends on how far they're willing to go. For example, if you have a 45-year-old, a lot of 45-year-olds will choose to do treatment, but the success rates on 45-year-olds, for instance, are very low, and usually those patients are recommended to go to donor egg. So if you're in your late 40s, for example, you may not want to see a fertility specialist unless you're willing to go to that sort of treatment.
Tell me about donor egg. What does that mean?
Well, what happens is you get older, the number and most importantly, the quality of the eggs go down. Most people are familiar with the fact that women who are in their 40s have a higher risk of Down syndrome. And the reason that's the case is because the eggs tend to be more likely to be chromosomally abnormal. And if you remember a process you learned back in high school called meiosis, meiosis kind of goes weird, and certain of the eggs, and sperm for that matter, will get too much or too little DNA. And that causes the chromosomes to be abnormal and causes unsuccessful cycles. It causes miscarriages, and it also causes Down syndrome.
Okay. I was asleep during that part of my education, by the way. But thank you for the update. So, okay, so is there an age limit that a patient comes in where they're going to have to do the donor egg, or does it depend?
Well, I mean, I'll do it up to 45, but I would say beyond 43, I discourage it.
But what about, I hear Janet Jackson had a baby when she was 50, because I hear that a lot from the patients.
Right.
So what about that?
Well, the media gives people unrealistic expectations about what human fertility is really like.
Really?
Yes. What happens, a lot of these celebrities are using donor eggs, and some of the other ones that don't use donor eggs are using eggs or embryos that they had frozen when they're younger.
Hmm.
So if you, let's say you're 35 years old and you decide to do IVF and you have a baby and there's frozen embryos, well, those frozen embryos from your 35 will work almost as well at 35 as they will when you're 48.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So all is not what it seems, I guess.
Not even close, no.
So let's say I'm coming in, we have a discussion, we do all the testing, and you say you need IVF to get pregnant. What's the process? What am I going to expect?
Well, IVF, as you've probably ascertained, is a complex process, but we kind of break it down into steps. The first step is doing the preliminary testing. So by the time you're at this point, you may have had it. We check for your ovarian reserve to make sure you're not running out of eggs. We do something called the sonohistogram to make sure the cavity is normal. We check the semen analysis. And then we suppress you with either birth control pills or a drug called Lupron. And that shuts your ovary down and throws you into temporary menopause. And then we give you fertility drugs to make your eggs grow. During that time, you come into the office fairly frequently, and then you get a shot of a hormone called HCG, which gives you what we call a fake LH surge, and 36 hours later, we harvest the eggs in the laboratory while you're asleep, and then we grow the embryos in the lab, and 3 or 5 days later, we put the embryos back in and hopefully freeze whatever's later, and about 14 days after we put them in, you find out if you're pregnant.
Okay, and then I assume if it's successful, then I guess you get ultrasounds to follow how the pregnancy is progressing, et cetera.
Sure. Well, we start out doing blood work. So we do blood work about twice a week until your levels get high enough.
What do you check for?
We check for two things. One's called HCG, which is pregnancy hormone. So when you do a home pregnancy test, that's what you're checking for in the urine, but we're doing this in the blood. And a progesterone level to make sure the progesterone that we're supplementing with you for you is adequate.
Okay, so we do the ultrasounds, check the levels, and then how far along do I have to be before I could continue as any other pregnant woman
does?
Well,
you graduate at 8 weeks, so we do
Is there a ceremony?
No ceremony now.
Okay, oh well.
Actually, a lot of patients have a difficult time with it. because they're losing their sphere of safety and they're all excited. But at that point, it's really time to move on to see their obstetrician. So that's when we send them off.
Well, being an obstetrician, I will tell you also on the flip side, when they come to me, they go through what I call ultrasound withdrawal because they're so used to getting an ultrasound with you. Then they come to me and I say, yeah, we'll do maybe 3 ultrasounds during the course of the whole pregnancy. And they're like, what?
Well, I try to tell them that, but everyone's very excited. So the reason we do this is that people who have infertility issues tend to be more likely to have ectopic or tubal pregnancies, and they tend to be more likely to have miscarriages, and they also tend to be more likely to have multiple births. So we want to know all that stuff as much as we can. I would say most of my patients would probably like to have ultrasounds even more than I do them.
Tell me about multiple births. Sorry, you mentioned that. If I'm going to do this, am I going to have 5, 6 children at the same time?
That kind of stuff's pretty rare nowadays. There's a bunch of things we're doing to reduce that.
Tell me about it.
Number one is the fertility drugs that we're using. It used to be common as a first line for fertility drugs to use Clomid, which is a pill similar to tamoxifen that women use for breast cancer. And we use that to stimulate ovulation. We've been substituting with that with a drug called Femara or letrozole, which actually has a lower multiple birth rate. But that's a relatively minor portion. The other thing is with IVF, when we do IVF, we're putting back fewer embryos in people. Mm-hmm. And that's making the biggest difference.
Right, because you used to, in the past, you put in a lot of embryos because you were worried that you wouldn't have any stick, for lack of a better word.
Well, that's exactly what would happen. And in fact, when I started in practice, if I had a 30-year-old, it might be normal to put back 4 embryos. There was nothing unusual about that at the time. Now, the question is whether we put back 1 or 2.
Now, what if a patient requests to put back in 4 or 5 because they want that instant family because on television it looks so cute?
Well, it depends how old they are. If I had a 30-year-old or a 35-year-old, I would flat out say no.
Okay.
But if I had a 40-year-old, I'll put in a lot of embryos, not because we want them to have a huge family, but because in a 40-year-old, the chance of more than 1 or 2 sticking are very small.
Gotcha.
Right? So we're not really worried about that. I will sometimes put in 1 extra if the patient requests, but more than that, no.
Okay. So what do patients typically ask you when they come in for their initial visit? So in other words, the FAQ, what are the frequently asked questions patients want to know?
Well, they want to know how many shots they're going to get.
Right. How many? So tell us.
Well, it depends. It depends what they're doing. The shots could go on for a number of weeks. Most of the needles that we use nowadays are relatively small. So there are less shots than there used to be, but there's still a fair number.
And who administers the shots?
They administer it themselves.
And
we teach them what to do. Okay. But yeah, the patients have to do it because the shots oftentimes are at night or early in the morning, and they have to know how to be able to do that.
Okay. And what other frequently asked questions do you hear?
Well, obviously the question you asked before, am I going to have multiple births? Uh-huh. And they want to know if I can have a boy or a girl.
Okay. I was setting this. So what's that answer?
Well, the answer is yes, there's a way to do this. Mm-hmm. But let me explain to you what's involved.
Yeah, tell me.
So what's involved is doing something called PGS, or pre-implantation genetic screening. And it's also called CSS, or comprehensive chromosomal screening, by some places. And what we do is we do IVF. We grow the embryos out to day 5 or 6. And then instead of transferring the embryos back, we biopsy them. And we take some of the cells on the outside, and we send them off for genetic analysis. That takes about a week to come back, and instead of putting them back now, we put them back the next month in what we call a frozen embryo cycle, and we get a result back, and it tells us how many of each chromosome we have. So if when they look at the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, if there's 2 X's, there's a female, and there's 1 X and 1 Y, it's a male, and we also make sure the embryos aren't affected by Down syndrome and so forth. The problem is that insurance doesn't pay for that kind of genetic testing.
I was going to say.
And if you take all the embryos and you put them all together and you put them in, 1 or 2 at a time, the chances of pregnancy aren't really any higher than doing genetic testing.
I got you. So you mentioned insurance coverage. So my frequently asked question would be, well, how much does all this cost?
Well, if a patient was paying, not doing genetic testing, and they were paying out of pocket, an IVF cycle costs about $13,000. Now, we don't charge that much, mm-hmm. but after you add the medications and so forth into it, that's about what it comes to. Fortunately, in New Jersey, we have a mandate requiring coverage. The mandate has kind of fallen apart a little bit since the Affordable Care Act. But for folks who have New Jersey State insurance or work for one of the school districts, they still have reasonably good coverage. So really, it's just the cost of their copays in that situation.
Oh, okay. Oh, so theoretically, if you're in New Jersey and have a reasonable insurance, it's not something that'll break the bank.
Well, if it's reasonable, meaning that they cover this. And it's not always the best insurances that cover it or the worst insurances that don't. It's kind of varies.
Yeah.
But if you work for the state or a school district, odds are that you have good coverage for it.
So everybody needs to move to New Jersey. That's the take home and work for the state or the school district. Is there anything that I have not asked you that you wanted to, that you hear a lot or get questioned a lot about?
I think those are the main things people question about.
Okay. All right. I hope this was informative for everybody. And again, this was our initial podcast, so hopefully it didn't sound too horrible and we're interesting. And thank you very much. This is Dr. Bruce Pierce and Dr. Seth Dermott.